Special Thursday edition of the Presidio
Thursday night, not Thursday football, night.
Not the
but Thursday night PBJ,
an emergency jam,
emergency jam,
and the emergency is we're all here and it's a good.
Well, we missed last week, we're missing the show.
Yep.
So we're here, and then we are at the Presidio Bitcoin Open Source AI Summit.
Yep,
today.
Yeah,
and tomorrow.
Yep.
So
no jam tomorrow.
So no jam tomorrow, but we're like, hey, let's do it. Let's do an
impromptu evening
jam.
That's right. And DK's in town, so we gotta take advantage to be back
and
in studio.
Next week too.
Oh, yeah. Even better. All right.
So two in a row. Yeah.
So we'll have to make sure we
so
come
you
to
better,
the studio.
You
there
be
we go.
Too,
yeah, right? Yeah. I'm here. I'm back too. Yeah.
And we're gonna try to keep it to, well, maybe 47 minutes till 6 or so Pacific.
We'll but anyway. Yeah.
We have a lot to cover, though, right?
Yeah.
We definitely want to talk about today's event. But
oh, yeah.
I want to touch on Blockstream Liquid a bit, because that was a huge hack. And there's some lessons learned there and some interesting conversation about that.
You want to start there? You want to start with
the... Yeah, and then let's time box it so we don't spend the whole show talking about Blockstream Liquid. But last weekend, Labor Day weekend, so for those that don't know what Blockstream Liquid is, it is a, I don't know, the controversy about it's a sidechain, but it's a system in which you can deposit Bitcoin into it. It's a federated system where I believe they have like 15 different entities, each hold a key. 11 of the 15 have to sign to spend out of that system. So
do you know are the people who wants to put money in there? Like, what are there certain use cases where that kind of thing? Really
it does support confidential transactions. So if privacy, like really good privacy, is important to you, that would be a reason you use it. Also, just for
you need your counterparty you're paying to also be using that. Is that what you're doing?
Yeah. So when you deposit your real Bitcoin into Liquid, you get LLBDC or Liquid BTC token. Which then you can do things within that system. And then whenever you want out, you can exit as long as the 11 of the 15 entities in the Federation sign your transaction, and then you can exit. I think there's some stable coins on there. I think like Aqua Wallet and Mana Wallet and a few other wallets used it as well as like a scaling solution, reach more users, lower fees, et cetera.
And so, interestingly, you can hook up, for example, like Lightning on top of Liquid as well. So you can have potentially swaps between Bitcoin and Lightning via the Lightning network too. I don't know if that's popular, but...
Yeah, I mean, this has been a product Blockstream's worked on for literally like 10 years.
Yeah, yeah.
It's also like kind of a test bed of new Bitcoin concepts that haven't yet gotten consensus or enough traction. Since Blockstream controls the Liquid system, they're able to add new features. So it's kind of an interesting experimental testbed as well. In any case, I didn't know how much money was in Liquid, but
we know now how much money was not in Liquid.
Well, there's there's like 4,200 BTC in Liquid. Something like $350 to $400 million of value in Liquid. So it's substantial amount of money.
It's more than I thought too, actually.
And then, so the event last weekend, all of a sudden there are like red alerts on social media saying that, 4,000 Bitcoin were withdrawn from Liquid to one address, to one actor. Which was certainly not an expected transaction to occur. So then it's like, oh my God, there's been a theft. How did it occur, right? And so, I mean, what we know now is there was a vulnerability in the consensus algorithm that allowed for inflation. So LBTC was created that shouldn't have been created. And this attacker like learned of this, created 4,000 LBTC out of thin air, then formed a valid transaction. So the signers, the 11 signers that had to sign it, are like looked at it, and their software looked at it, and it's like it's valid, and so it exited, and then it exited to, the money can only exit to certain entities. I think the same or some either a superset or the same entities that are the functionaries of this federation, and then what I've learned is I think many or most have certain policies in place when it is withdrawn. Like there might be velocity controls where you can only withdraw so much out of their, I mean, once it's gone out of Liquid into their own Bitcoin hot wallet or cold wallet, there might be velocity controls on how fast it can be withdrawn out of that wallet to the ultimate
and the
recipient.
Signers themselves are some sort of like a, they're sort of like a financial services or a Bitcoin focused financial service, like an exchange?
In theory, one thing though,
it's not public, right?
It's not public.
Yeah.
They used to be public, then they're not public. So we actually don't know. I mean, like,
you can guess a lot of the major players, but
you can guess, like, probably Tether was one and maybe Breeze was one. I don't know. We don't know who they are. That was intentional. I mean, there's a trade off there. I think they wanted to reduce regulatory exposure. That's why they wanted to be more on the down low. But then as a user of the system, it's way less transparent.
Right.
I mean, like in the most adversarial minded case, it could just be like Blockstream holds all 15 keys.
Yeah, it's
just one, you know. So, I mean, I don't think that's actually the case, but it could be. And so anyway, but it turns out there was a service called Sideswap, which was one of the functionaries, and they did not implement KYC or velocity controls. So if you use their service to swap out, then you withdraw LBDC to real Bitcoin through the 11, and that's an 11 and 15 multisig. Then that went into a side swap wallet.
Mm-hmm.
And then from there, you can withdraw to your own wallet. And that, all that can be done instantly, no velocity controls, no KYC. So that's the path the attacker took to steal these Bitcoin. Now, I'm calling it stealing and theft. This attacker left a message in the Bitcoin blockchain claiming that they're a white hat hacker initially.
Was that was with the move of the 4,000?
Yeah. When
they said,
exactly.
I'm white hat, we're just here to help
I'm a white hat hacker. I think it was white hat hacker is how it was described, but definitely white hat.
Yeah.
And at the time, no one knew, right? All we knew is that 4,000 Bitcoin were just withdrawn. Holy shit.
Yeah.
And it says white hat hacker. And then what transpired was fascinating because then there was exchange back and forth over the Bitcoin blockchain in op returns between Blockstream and this attacker to communicate. And some of that was in plain text and some of it was encrypted where only, you know, those two parties could see the messages. So we don't know everything that was exchanged, but to cut a long story short, the attacker did return 3,400 BTC, so a huge portion, but still kept 15% or 600 BTC. And it, you know, because a lot of the communication we can't see, it's unclear if that's just like the next step of the negotiation, or from the attacker's perspective, that's just like
that's
they're
their
claiming that's their
$50 million about it.
and as far as I know, that's sort of where things stand.
Okay. And there's been some drama back and forth, between them. And
yeah, well, and then it's also interesting to see the chatter and commentary on the situation. Like, there's some people on Twitter and in the Bitcoin space that cheer this person on and don't think it's criminal, and they endorse it. And I find that difficult to swallow. Like if you take someone's property and then you decide that you're going to keep 15% and give it back to them, like because they didn't the most superior lock on their door or whatever.
Right.
I'm sorry, but that's still property rights violation and theft. I think they went far beyond what any sensible definition of white hat hacker is, and just from a purely like ethical standpoint. The legal system can deal with it as well. And I'm quite certain the legal system would call that a criminal case.
Yeah, I mean, I'm curious. So I think the sort of the other side would be, and we don't know because a lot of this was encrypted communications, but if I guess Liquid or Blockstream agreed to those numbers, now one can say, you know, it's one thing to negotiate when you're sitting there, hey, I've got all of your money. I'll give you back 85% if you agree not to prosecute, which again, kind of changes it from white to gray because the cynical look on that, right, is, if the hacker didn't have that and they sort of said, hey, I've got a bug bounty ahead of time, like, would you give me, $50 million to not reveal? Like, that's a very different negotiation. But
but I mean, another thing I learned, I mean, it would have been my intuition, but I learned also like the criminal case is not impacted by.
Oh, really?
If Blockstream agrees, there can still be a criminal case.
Interesting.
Still theft.
Why is that? If they gave consent to keep it back, or I guess would that be a civil case or something?
I suspect it's because like when you're under duress like that, I mean, yeah, like the criminal law is like sort of independent of like the duress of the victim.
Oh.
But in any case, that's where that lands. Now, another interesting tidbit is, we just got done speaking. We just wrapped up day one of the summit.
Yep.
And a panel that I was on with three other folks, we talked about AI security scanning.
Yeah.
And it turns out that the red team. So we had CEO Rob Hamilton on my panel.
Super CEO.
We love talking about on the show, and super CEO. Doesn't really know how to code. Just kidding, Rob. But he jokes himself. He's a security professional now in the past 6 weeks, right? Because ever since the cold card incident, he jumped into gear and has been, you know, burning the midnight oil, doing security scanning of many open source Bitcoin projects. Many other Bitcoiners joined him. So there were folks from the red team that found a vulnerability in Liquid, reported it, and that was the one it's public information. That was a vulnerability dating back to like 2018 or 2019. So it's been in the code for a long, long time. And then the fix for that introduced a worse vulnerability. Oh, no. It was like easier to exploit. It was a similar type of. So this has to do with the confidential transactions and the range proofs. Anyway, I won't get into the technical details, but
all good reason it's not implemented on Bitcoin.
But the fix didn't. The fix introduced a worse bug, and that's what was exploited. And there's drama on Twitter today, where I think the red team saying they also reported the correct fix, and then there's a dispute on whether that was looked at or not by Blockstream. But
reported the correct fix ahead of time?
Yeah. Or meaning like explicitly noted the wrong fix was a concern, and here's the right. There's like a second email.
I see.
So we'll see how that transpires. But that was the actual vulnerability. So again, it gets back to this AI security scanning. Like AI is able to find these vulnerabilities so quickly and easily. Another thing that arose from this that I thought found interesting is like the people were criticizing federations and the value of federations. And it actually got me to thinking in ways I hadn't really thought about before. Because in general, I just naively thought like, you know, federation gives you more security. You know, I'm not just trusting you, but I'm, you know, it's you and a couple others, let's say that we know that it's distinct entities, right? I mean, even if we, let's just hold that as a given. But that's not necessarily the case. So in this situation, there's 15 different entities, but as far as we can tell, you know, they would, whatever the software releases that Blockstream produced, they just updated.
Right.
They didn't like, and I don't know this is fact, but it appears to be the case. You know, they just like update the software, trust Blockstream, and don't audit it themselves.
Right.
Don't do any kind of like,
yeah,
you know, checking there. And so that there's many aspects of centralization, but that aspect would then be centralized because Blockstream, I mean, ended up being, you know, one developer did the fix, one reviewed it got merged, and then like my guess is no one else looked at it.
Yeah.
And they just sort of accepted the software. So that seems pretty weak. And then another weakness that was revealed was this, again, getting back to when Bitcoin's withdrawn from Liquid, I learned that it's like best practices that are given to the entities or the functionaries or whatever to do spending velocity controls, maybe do KYC as well, but like put these protections in place.
Cold storage. Not like it goes from Liquid to their system.
But it's a holding period, and there's controls in place,
right.
Such that you know, the entire liquidity in Liquid can't be exited in real time, you know, in one transaction, right, all in one go. And but one of the functionaries, Sideswap, wasn't doing that. So there was a weakness there,
right,
as well. Like, you know, so I don't know what the right answer is. Should the Liquid protocol enforce these, like, add spending velocity controls? And if so, what should they be? That gets tricky, but, you know. And I mean, you know, adding KYC, I don't think it's probably the right answer to the protocol. So, but it raised that issue as well. And then, like, I saw some people tweeting, comparing, like, custodians to federations and,
yeah,
you know, coming up with some formula where, like, you know, if like, two-thirds of the entities in your federation are worse, lower quality than, like, one custodian, you're better off with just one custodian, which,
yes,
is some, not exactly what you said in the past, but it's in the right, in the same direction as what you've said.
Yeah, and I was going to kind of make that point again. I mean, to me, I think there's a lot of interesting, you know, points in this, but, you know, I actually think Saylor actually put that in. He had that nice, like, tweet storm, I guess. I don't know if it was like the Bitcoin maximalism or whatever. Sorry, where he made the point, it's like, I think we, from the early days of Bitcoin, you know, maybe took a lesson that was important, but made it the only lesson, which is not your keys, not your coins, or, like, you know, the right to hold keys is an obligation to hold keys. And I think, you know, the way I'm seeing this move increasingly is, like, it's not that, like, you should never trust a custodian, or, you know, take everything yourself, or never trust a side chain ever, like, all side chains are bad, or all Lightning Network nodes are bad, or whatever. I think the point this all raises to me is, like, in an open system with free competition and transparency, you should evaluate and really see which custodians and counterparties you trust. And obviously, I'm still saying you should have the right to hold keys if you want, but for most people, which custodians you trust, mm-hmm, which side chains, which Lightning implementations, which Lightning Network nodes. And I think one of the big takeaways that's been interesting for me is, I think as a community, you know, I don't think it's a bad thing. You know, and look, we're the canary in the coal mine. We're the ones taking the AI stuff first. But you know, I think that a lot of this has come out of sort of hacker culture, side projects, maybe companies that, you know, like, I'd be curious within Blockstream, and not to, like, call them out or whatever, but, like, I'm guessing Liquid was not their number one focus at this time. And it's like, you know, if you're a company where maybe you, at one point you were focused on something, and then, you know, it's not like a fault of your own, but, like, priorities shifted, there's new business opportunities, and maybe there's just, like, one person kind of, like, left on the maintenance staff, then, you know, if that's still securing serious funds, then that's a problem. So I think, you know, where I hope all of this is going to go in the open system is, the services that people use and trust, hopefully there's an easier way for people to, you know, to realize, like, custodying with Block or using something that came out of Block software, which has, you know, whatever, a lot of really qualified people, top of the line models, is not the same as, like, the weekend hacker project that's storing 4,000 of your BTC. And there's a wide spectrum in between.
And
I'm not saying that Blockstream is that, but
the last aspect that got brought up that didn't really get enough discussion, I don't think, but that someone raised the point about liability, yeah, from the entities. So there's, yeah, you know, these 15 different companies, and it's unclear how much liability each of those companies has with this theft.
Right.
Like, could there be lawsuits for people who lost money? And if that were ever the case and it was established that there is liability with those entities, is there enough value in it for them to, like, would that dissuade anyone from,
yeah, like, what's to be the part benefit of the Federation? To being a signatory or whatever? Like, is there any benefit to running one of those?
I mean, mainly that you at least get your sort of vote, in terms of, like, on, you might be using the system.
Yeah.
So you want honest actors. So mm-hmm, you want to at least be one of them. I mean, Spark has the same. All right, you know, Spark is federated. Fediment is federated. Those, mm-hmm, are two other systems in the ecosystem that have federations. And right, so with Spark, there's one entity, which is LightSpark, but then there's Spark operators. And I don't know where they're at now, but they started with two, and now I think they're at three. Maybe they have more now. But there'd be the same question there. You know, why do you want to do it? Now, with the way Spark works, like, let's say we built a wallet. And it was a Spark-based wallet. Our incentive to be an operator in Spark would be that Spark only needs one honest actor,
yeah,
to make sure. And so, totally, like, then we just have to trust ourselves, right?
Right, yeah.
And that's easier than trusting a bunch of other companies that you don't have.
You don't know who they are.
You're not able to observe their internet. So that would be a reason. Also, potentially business model, they can cut fees and stuff like that. So there definitely can be incentives, but it'll be interesting to see if that's tested around liability. Now, where did things wind up? Blockstream just, so they paused the Liquid's system last weekend. They just started it again today. I think last I checked, withdrawals are still not enabled, but the actual blockchain is producing blocks again. So this Liquid is a block-based system. Hmm. Not Block Inc., but blocks of transactions.
A chain of blocks.
A chain of blocks. And they restarted that. And Adam Back said that it will be one for one.
Interesting. So they're plugging the hole then.
So somehow it will be one for one,
meaning anybody's going to be made whole.
Yeah, because with Liquid, if it's a 50% haircut, the way Liquid works is it's not evenly applied to everyone. It's a rush for the exits. Like, let's say we're all in Liquid, and the moment they turn that on, it would be a fight for who gets their money out first, because the last 15% gets zero.
It's like the banking system.
It would be unfair, and it would be it would probably be the death of Liquid. I mean, is Liquid going to survive anyway? I don't know, but that would definitely be the death. But no, he announced that it will be one for one. So somehow
someone plugged it.
Some way, 600 BTC are being plugged, apparently independent of whether they get it back from this attack. Mm. So
yeah, very interesting story.
That's the Liquid story.
Is it kind of settled and done now, or are we going to keep following this and there's more stuff?
Well, mainly, I mean, even through today, there's still opportune messages going back and forth between.
Oh, they are with the hacker.
Yeah. So, are those 600 Bitcoin returned? Is this person apprehended? I mean, that's a future thing. And then, who made Blockstream whole? Is it from Blockstream Treasury or individuals or investors? Like Tether's been a historical backer, so you know they'd have the funds to do it. But what's their incentive if they did?
Yeah. Right. Right.
Anyhow, and with Binance, or sorry, Bitfinex had a big hack long ago, like 2015 or 2016.
Yeah.
In which way more than 4,000 Bitcoin were stolen. I think it was like.
It was a lot. I forget.
100, or I think it was like 100,000 or 180,000 Bitcoin or something.
Huge amount. Yeah.
Because Bitcoin was not, it was like $200 a Bitcoin then.
Right.
But they got themselves out of that by issuing a token. I actually think it was one of the more. It's one of the few tokens.
It's called the USD, and
Tether. Yeah. Now, this token actually is like a reasonable use case, in my opinion, and that it's almost like a futures contract. I mean, it's kind of like you think they're gonna eventually make it whole, and I don't.
Yeah.
So maybe I sell you my and then I was a depositor, so they gave me some tokens. Mm-hmm. For the haircut I took, and then I'm like, I don't believe in this future, so I sell it to you, and it seems like, and it just gets around. You can probably do that through some bankruptcy court or regulatory court, or they take 10 years, and
right, like an on-chain version.
They could just do right away. So yeah. I don't know. This is actually an interesting token, but anyway.
And did they get any? Is there any kind of fingerprint on the hack that suggests it happened because of a brand new AI model, or it was just kind of sitting out there hidden in plain sight and anybody could have done this? Or
well, that fix that ended up having a worse vulnerability than what it fixed was made open source September 1st, and then September 7th or 8th is when the hack occurred, I think, so within a week. So those are the facts. So I don't think there was a new model in that week. So I don't think that would explain it, but I've got to believe.
Probably,
I
mean, just people taking some of the new models and.
Yeah, I mean, if there's 4,000 Bitcoin bounties, I'm going to be looking at, and I want to steal it.
Yeah.
I'm going to be looking at every new patch from Liquid and toss it into my security scanner and then be like, okay, I'll take 4,000 Bitcoin.
Right.
I mean, do you guys have any opinion on the white/gray hat thing here? I mean, do you think? I mean, that's kind of unprecedented. Like, do you have any strong feelings on that?
Yeah, I think this is egregious and criminal and unethical and should be condemned, not encouraged.
Yeah, I think if you're saying I think you can't claim white hat and then decide how much reward you get to keep.
Yeah.
Like, why don't I say I'm a white hat and I'm keeping 99%?
Exactly.
I
mean,
just, you're going to go rob a jewelry store. And
I totally agree. Just to feel, man, I mean, if someone took the other side, they'd be like, well, it just needs to be reasonable, right? So like if they took 1%, then it'd be, oh, that was a reasonable bounty. So then it gets into debate.
Slope.
Yeah, it's slippery slope. And also,
according to who?
So the amount or percentage is up for debate. But then also, like, who's dictating the terms? And I think historical norms for white hacking is
liquid.
You as the white hat don't dictate the terms. Yeah. Because that's extortion.
Yeah. It's not white hat anymore.
I mean, it's literally criminal extortion.
Turn to black hat. Yeah.
Right. So to me, it's black and white, not gray.
Yeah, yeah.
On that. But interesting. It's actually really odd to me that like Bitcoiners who are always about like, you know, taxation is theft. It's like, oh, but it's totally fine to steal 4,000 Bitcoin and keep 15% of it. That's not theft.
It's a tax.
Anyhow. All right. Let's talk about.
Let's talk about some open source AI stuff because that was today.
So,
where do we begin?
Yeah. Well, we're doing, there's a 2-day event in the Presidio, hosted by Presidio Bitcoin, the Open Source AI Summit.
Yep.
First of all, let me give a shout out to the people who have made this happen.
Oh, yeah.
Haley, on my team. Austin who's Spiral grantee. And then Alex, who leads PB. And the three of them work here out of PB.
They've done a lot of work.
We've put on a lot of great summits, including your Type 1 Energy Summit. But this one is like
bigger.
Next level. It's bigger. We're not even hosting it here at PB because we had over 130 people today. And I think after tomorrow, we'll have like over, you know, like around 150 unique people who are coming to this summit. Today was out of the Golden Gate Club. Beautiful venue. Really nice.
Amazing.
And we were able to get like an all-star set of folks as well. I mean, we had talked about in the show maybe a month ago that David Sachs agreed to speak. So I was able to have a great conversation with him, and we can dive into that more if you'd like. Obviously it's a big name, but we've had many others as well.
Yeah.
Including tomorrow. I'll let you guys talk a little bit about the speakers today and what you found interesting. But tomorrow we have like a VP from Hugging Face opening up tomorrow.
Yeah.
And then a VP, the guy in charge of Nemotron, open source model for NVIDIA, closes tomorrow.
That's a pretty big deal.
It's a really good cast of folks.
Yeah, and I was super impressed to see. I mean, just really in the last couple of weeks, it came together and it started being, you know, obviously with the good summit, hopefully this is what happens is it starts off, you know, it's like a little bit slow to get going. Then as you get going, you know, everyone wants in, then all of a sudden, the scarce seats are taken. But it was really cool just to see how much demand there was. It was really cool to see that this summit was a mix. You know, there's people from the, you know, sort of Bitcoin world that are mixing with like the actual, you know, people that are building the open source AI, you know, the, you know, sort of vanguard here in Silicon Valley. And this is the first event that I've seen where like that was like really mixed. And
yeah,
I hope
a nice crossover.
I hope
it's
really crossover. Good stuff will come out.
I think the number, like 2/3 of the attendees are like not Bitcoin. They're AI people.
Even better.
And a third are Bitcoin, but even the third that are Bitcoin are people who are very much in AI, using AI, or very AI pilled.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that was cool.
Who are some of your like favorite speakers or topics or panels?
Or people you met?
I want to make sure I get his name right. Is it Ramez Nam?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Ramez.
Okay. I liked his, I wasn't familiar with his work, but I guess he's a sci-fi author. So he's got 3 sci-fi books. And I liked the way he kind of showed the transition of what's happening with kind of, you know, I think a lot of time, you know, in 2022, everybody said, oh, OpenAI, fully central, they're going to just run the table with this. And he sort of showed how, I think in 2022 or so, they had like a 20-month lead. And then in, I think, 2023 or 4, that shrunk to 5-month lead. And now it's basically, you know, every few weeks there could be like a new leader. I think that's like a really promising idea to have illustrated that way. And especially to do it in, you know, it's, instead of AI being this huge centralizing force, it could be a plurality of AIs. And so I thought it was actually interesting to see him bring that data to the story. And I mean, I'm optimistic. I think I've been optimistic and continue to be optimistic that there's going to be intelligence everywhere. It's not going to be a single monopolistic winner. I don't think, even if there's recursive self-improvement, I think there will be, I know Max may disagree, but I think I think there's going to be a lot of AI, and it's going to be benefit of humanity to have so many different alternative
options. And he created a really compelling case that that is going to be true, right? So I thought, I totally agree with that. I thought he brought great energy. He opened the event, right? So he brought great energy. He also opened Type 1,
He also opened Type 1.
Oh, yeah.
And I got to give a shout out to him. Mez is probably, I mean, certainly one of my favorite living futurists. He was the guy that actually solar pilled me back in like 2015. He was the first one to really show the Moore's Law of Solar, I think in like 2011, an article for Scientific America. Wow. So he's really always ahead of the curve. And I mean, yeah, it's a very hopeful message that, I mean, I want to believe I'm getting there, but regardless, it's a hopeful message. So,
We're lucky to, we're fortunate to have him come to our events and help out that way. And just for those listening and you're maybe curious and want to watch the summit, it was recorded. It wasn't live streamed though. So I think it'll probably be next week when all the recordings are made available, but we will be publishing it, including Remes's.
Sweet.
We're trying to rush the David Sacks one to get it out by tomorrow, midday, because I mean, we're excited to have him be part of the summit. And then, you know, what happened yesterday, right?
I was offline. I missed this. So give me the setup. What happened?
Well, so there is this employee at Anthropic who just quit. So ex-employee just quit Anthropic, tweeted out talking about like he's worried about the end of humanity, greater than 10% chance that we're all going to die in the next couple of years. Very dramatic.
Standard Anthropic fare.
very dramatic and apocalyptic message, but with no substance. Or it's not like,
he didn't reveal any new information.
No. Yeah. I mean, as David Sacks joked, like, I mean, usually if you're a whistleblower, I mean, he's being framed as a whistleblower. Number one, usually the company that you left is not on your side and supporting you. And in this case, many Anthropic employees were retweeting it and supporting this apocalyptic message. Also, this person only worked there 6 weeks.
Only worked at Anthropic for 6 weeks.
For 6 weeks,
and he had like no Twitter history.
And I don't know how old he is, but I mean, look, he looks quite young. I mean, I think he's early in his career.
Sacks called it a psyop.
And then I think he tweeted maybe Tuesday night or something. But then like all day Wednesday, he's on like all these mainstream media interviews.
Did he say he was like on national news and is he on Rogan?
Well, Rogan covered it. The Wall Street Journal, or either the New York Times or Wall Street Journal, also published an article like 18 minutes before the tweet that was like about or the tweet.
Yeah.
And then it was Joe Rogan. It was just, like, clearly orchestrated. Like dozens of politicians retweeted this with their message to their constituents, et cetera. So clearly, I mean, obviously the stuff that wasn't just spontaneous, I think. But in any case, it created a firestorm. And I mean, the concern here, at least from if you're a supporter of open weight models and distributed versus centralized, then the concern here is that this is going to create rapid momentum where Congress acts and introduces legislation and possibly regulatory frameworks that are very draconian, where companies like Anthropic and OpenAI have it just creates its regulatory capture and creates a moat for them. And everyone else in open models might not even be able to comply.
And specifically, I mean, I think it's worth stating it kind of, I don't know if the exact words he used, but if regulatory capture, if basically can create a panic, then the regulators say, okay, we have to deal with the panic. Way to deal with the panic is to talk to somebody, so the leaders of OpenAI, leaders of Claude, Anthropic, and then you build legislation and regulation that supports their needs, but then any of the open source stuff is sort of out in the cold. There's nobody to talk to. They're not involved in the conversation. And so I think part of the story he was saying is, let's figure out how to, as a kind of open source, plurality of models, how do those things sort of have a voice at the table and sort of avoid the regulatory capture from being able to be completed, right?
Yeah, and I think that's an important point that it doesn't necessarily have to be as draconian as open source is banned. But like, you know, for example, if you have like, you know, a fintech regulation that says we have to speak to your CEO, it's like, well, Bitcoin doesn't have a CEO. Yeah. So I mean, I'd like to believe that, you know, people are going to see through some of that, but I don't know. But I mean,
people are really, you know, the PSYOP, the orchestration, the media, you can create a lot of confusion.
Also, you already have, you know, it's common. The AI sentiment is quite negative
already
among a lot of mainstream folks.
Right.
So you have that, and then these extreme messages just confirms their existing priors.
Yeah.
So if something confirms your priors, you're less inquisitive. You're less like, what? Totally. Where's the data? Where's the evidence?
Like, that's what I thought was
going to happen. It's like, yep, that's what I thought.
Yeah.
AI is bad for us. So it is kind of set up for a disaster where then, of course, why are the politicians glomming onto this? I actually don't think they really care about AI safety or think that we're all going to die in 2 years. They want votes and they want donations.
Right? Well, I mean, to be fair, just play devil's advocate a little bit on this. I mean, I think that's probably true for a lot of them. I do actually believe a lot of people at Anthropic really do believe this. And I think increasingly, if you keep saying that to some of these people and they're telling their story, I do think a lot of people probably are, even in you know, politics, generally afraid of that message. I think there's both sides to that.
I agree, I agree with that, but I just think that, like, that's lunacy in the sense that no one's answering, what about the Chinese open
model? Yeah.
And I asked David that.
And that was a great question from you. In fact, I thought that was one of your best questions was like, okay, you know, if we try and ban open source and just cede it to the Chinese, then what? And like, I thought his response was also pretty funny.
Well, I asked him to steel man it because I know he doesn't hold that position.
Yeah.
Well, so no, like, steel man it. And, you know, he did try to steel man it, which was, you know, they would say that we need, he didn't say it this way, but like sort of a nuclear or non-proliferation treaty with China or something. And I
tend to agree with him on this point. Yeah, exactly. Where he was
a global pause.
I mean, he basically said these people are living in, you know, a fantasy land. I tend to agree with that. There's no chance that, like, people are going to agree to pause.
Because one data point that he pointed out,
when Elon was trying to do the global pause on it?
Elon?
Yeah.
Yeah.
When?
Before XAI had a seat at the table. He was like, hey, we got to slow it all down. Let me catch up.
Yeah, sorry, man. That hurts your fanboyism a little bit there.
Hey, man, listen, I don't agree on everything. I don't agree on everything.
But a stat that David mentioned was some survey in China, like 83% of the population is like, you know, has positive sentiment on AI. And I don't know what the stats are in the US, but it's more of the opposite of that, right? So if you have a population of over a billion people, 83%
are
pro AI,
and
you're, you know, doing well with AI, you see the future of it, like, are you going to pause because the US has a chat with you?
Yeah.
No. I think that really reinforced for me this idea that China, you know, at writ large, one, has seen, you know, a lot of people come out of poverty. They've seen technology be great for them. So they're like, okay, this is going to be more of the same, more welfare, like more economic progress, let's say. But I also think it's interesting. And like, I'd be curious to see more of like a debate between, you know, Chinese lab leaders and lab leaders in the US, because I really do think there's a fundamental breakdown. And you could be totally cynical and say, no, it's all just like lying, regulatory capture. Maybe you could be totally there, you know, really believe in it. Maybe it's a mix of both. But it really does seem like there's a fundamental divide of, you know, in China, at least from everything I've heard, they see it as a tool, as a new technology, like all these other technologies akin to something like the web or a train or, you know, airplanes, whatever. Whereas, this group of sort of the EA people, and to be fair, I think a lot of them really, truly, fundamentally believe it, think that this could run away, be gray goo, paperclip maximization, you know, biological weapons, whatever, pick your flavor on there. So I'd be curious, like, I would love to see some of these leaders from China or whatever lab people from China and the US actually talk about it and see if they can like move each other's minds at all or not. But that does seem to be a stark difference.
Yep. So we're going to do our best to get the David Sacks conversation out by midday tomorrow. Ashu, are you doing that work?
I think you just got assigned while he's here producing.
I'll tell you, shout out to Ashu.
Ashubot, begin next day.
No, he's you need like three clones or agents of yourself, Ashu, because he's been doing tons of work for the summit today.
Ashu's the man.
Summit,
then I'm like, hey, Ashu, can we get this Davis Axe video edited and post produced like ASAP. And then, Ashu, let's do an impromptu PBJ.
Yeah. I was just saying, finding Ashu, like, best thing that ever came out of the song. He's the man.
So thank you.
Yeah.
Let's see. What else about the summit? Either today or is there anything? I guess you're not going to be there tomorrow, but the two of us are. I mean, you had two panels yourself.
I had two panels. The last one was very interesting. I guess it was top of mind for me. It was on open protocols. And so that was super cool because, we talked about open protocols for identity, commerce, communications, and memory. And it was cool because I actually had four folks on there and I got it was both a variety of perspectives, but they also had like approached some of these different standards from different angles. So we had Elon Strauss, who's more of a sort of like philosopher guy that's written a lot with Tim O'Reilly. And it was good because he brought that perspective of kind of like, free markets, Hayek, move, information processing to the edge. And then we had three builders. And it was cool because, three of the four people had actually played with Nostra on identity. So obviously I turned a bit of a Nostra commercial. And the fourth was very open to it. And so it was really cool to hear Tom from Buzz talk about his experience building with Nostra, why they chose it. Obviously Roland from Albie and Taskful had a lot of experience. Perhaps the most exciting thing to me was that this guy, Sam Nightwing from Noose Research. Noose is, they make Hermes, which is, I think, the most popular agent right now, even more so than OpenClaw. They're very sort of open source, open mind, ethos. They haven't made a lot of these decisions yet. So it was interesting for him to get to sort of, learn and kind of ask some questions before and after as well. He seemed really interested.
You mentioned open source memory protocols.
Oh, yeah.
And I don't know much about it.
Yeah. I mean, I, to be frank, don't either. That was something that Elon brought up to me before the panel, and he's been pushing for it. I guess they're trying to get some coalition around this. I mean, I don't know the details of what he's pushing.
Agent memory or?
Yes. And okay. I think in general, the idea is like, you need to be able to have an easy way to export your memory or context wherever you go. And the more I thought about it, which is still limited, that's extremely important because like, that's the way they lock you in.
Yeah, yeah.
That is the lock in, right? Yeah. So if there's like some kind of easy standard, and I do not expect labs like to embrace that, but if you can get more of a community sentiment or like more of a sort of shelling point around how to do that, that to me is probably the most important thing to keep the ecosystem open.
But a tool like Buzz would be able to maybe even instigate, but certainly use an open source memory protocol.
100%.
Memory protocol?
Yeah.
Is that something you guys have talked about? Or
I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know either.
Not allowed to talk about it.
but I am ready for our next topic.
Oh boy.
He's getting ahead. But I do think it's interesting. I mean, you guys should chat with Elon. I'm glad. I'm also glad they all got to meet each other because like Tom now gets to talk to him a little bit. But I also think they were on the Buzz point, they were all very interested because this is one of the first environments where, the Hermes agent can talk with the OpenClaw agent. And I was trying to kind of get that point across of like, if you have, a forum like Buzz open, that's all based around open protocols. They talked about A2A and how it was easy to, put Hermes in there, even though Hermes hadn't done any work to integrate with Buzz. So I thought that was super cool. It showed the importance of open protocols.
I listened to a lot of it, but not all of it. Did you cover like standard traces, like formats for traces?
Not on that panel, no. That's a good question.
Yeah,
we didn't. But on the other panel that I did, which was kind of focused on the economics of open weights models, and then really we covered a lot of stuff. I just basically asked Christian Catalini, who I like a lot, and this guy John Komkov, who's a really really fascinating thinker. A lot of thoughts around autonomous agents. Both of them are very interested in, I guess, that question, how to like sort of like sign and validate, I guess, traces as well. I think it would be worth going even deeper with them on that. But
cool. Should we talk about Vora a little bit?
Let's do it.
So Vora is a company that operates out of PB. Folks we know and I guess
we're both investors.
But Jesse and Eric they've been at PB from the beginning, I think. And they did their product reveal today. I mean they've described what their product is about for quite a while now, but they actually had hardware in hand and did an Apple-esque reveal, which is kind of fun and cool. But the industrial design, I think, really caught our eyes.
Yeah, unbelievable.
I forget who all. I think maybe two of us. What popped out to you?
Well, okay. So at first, I have to say, I actually somehow missed it today. I didn't realize when Jesse was gone. So I want to see the video later. But I want to hear from you guys. But I did get sort of a private reveal yesterday, and I'm blown away. And like, you know, Jesse and Eric are obviously very smart. And, you know, I know Jesse has a long history with cryptography. So of course, I, you know, I was excited, you know, to back them. But it was one thing to hear them talk about it. It was another thing to see the finished product. And the guy they brought on that did hardware clearly is like a stud. I mean, I was literally, you know, because one question I've always had for them is like, you know, I believe this is going to be very popular. I think obviously Apple was super well positioned. I think obviously Apple is still very well positioned for it. You know, going after the consumer market versus enterprise is very challenging. But I do have to say, like, I see more of Jesse's vision now. It was truly like a beautiful, it was like a piece of wood, like real wood embossed with their cool logo. Like the box, like
it doesn't look like a tech product.
No,
it looks like something like you want to display speaker, in your living room, like, for
a,
your
like
home.
A, from the 70s, like a speaker or something.
It feels like, natural, like, yeah, like these guys.
Natural wood, kind of. Yeah.
The biggest thing I came away thinking is like this team now, it's craftsmen. Mm-hmm. Like the way to get really remarkable products is to really give a fuck, like really care, and then also have taste. And these guys do. And yeah, I see the vision for like, and for those of you who don't know, in case we haven't talked about it, imagine a box you plug in at your house. You can run local agents there. There's secure elements on the chip. They showed me the first motherboards. That's so cool. And they showed me the secure elements.
There's a honey badger.
Yeah.
The honey badger on there.
On the PCB.
Yeah. And they showed me there's two different secure elements. It's beautiful. And also how quickly they got this stuff done. And they were mentioning that obviously AI is accelerating a lot of the process. But like they got a lot of this stuff like manufactured and like the first run of the motherboards in like on the order of months, which would have normally taken, I'm guessing, like years in a past life. So yeah, I'm really excited.
But you're saying the product. I mean, so it's a hardware product.
Yeah.
You buy it. You, as a consumer, you buy it, put it in your home, plug it in, and it gives you privacy. I know they put a lot of attention and detail into security as well, like protecting against prompt injection attacks, which is a very difficult problem to solve.
Yeah.
That's the value proposition.
And do you use it basically like a web server to access almost like a ChatGPT or a Claude like interface directly from that as a web server, and then that has its own kind of GPU inside?
Yeah, I don't know if you like SSH into it or it's a web server or not.
I'm not sure of all the standards, but I think the ultimate thing is you have an app on your phone that connects. I don't know if it's SSH or not. But the one key thing I would call out is, and actually I'd be curious to get feedback from the audience. Right now, it's a very capable machine that you can run, you know, a lot of good models on. But the idea is not just that you do everything locally. The idea is you can sort of put a barrier between what you want to be stored locally for your memory and everything and, you know, outside calls. So you could still use this thing to call an instance of Claude or an instance of Codex or something else. Mm-hmm. And then they're really trying to be, I guess, the protective membrane between those. I do think, though, and I'm kind of like maybe pushing them a little bit. I'm curious y'all's take. You know, they kind of want to go more mass market. I'm telling them, you know, it'd be nice to even consider starting with like a super premium product with like max out the RAM, like letting me run the juiciest, beefiest models possible, charge a higher point.
The product they revealed today is 32 gigabyte?
64.
Okay. Is it 64?
Okay. Yeah, which is good. But like, I mean, you know.
Did they show you the light too?
Yeah.
Yeah, the light on the front.
It's sick.
Yeah, it's so well done.
I know.
I mean, people listening to this are probably like, okay, it has a light. But you just have to
see
it.
There's some wood.
It's a very warm, welcoming light. I forget exactly how they described it, but they described it in really
It's like a natural kind of aesthetic, right?
Yeah.
It's anti-blue light, so it was like kind of red.
A-plus on the industrial design.
Unbelievable.
So hopefully it is super easy to use. Like, plug it in and it works. I don't know yet, but hopefully that's the case. And
I can't wait to use it. I mean, I'm also pushing them. Whatever we can do with pre-orders, if it needs to be more expensive.
Did they announce a price point?
Well, I have some ideas, but I don't know if that's supposed to be public. But I told them if you could do a more expensive version to get it out faster for the first run.
It says you can reserve it for $10.
Yeah, I'm telling you that should be changed to be a little bit higher than $10.
But Vora.io is the website, VORA.io.
So contribute it to like a mesh LLM?
So that's where the ultimate vision is, right? Uh-huh. So I think sort of phase zero is you have these beautiful machines, but something that, you know, we've jammed a lot on over the years is like once you have that sort of infrastructure, now what can you build on top?
If only the people working on mesh LLM would want to add Bitcoin, and if only the people working on Vora would want to add Bitcoin.
Yeah, if only.
I think it'll work out. Which is one benefit of Bitcoiners like immersing themselves in the AI world.
Yeah.
Right?
But I don't know. I mean, Eric was telling me they're kind of leaning towards Sol right now. So we'll see.
Zcash. Zcash. Anyway, Zcash, all right.
Please.
This is the shortest episode we've ever done. Yeah, right. I'm actually super happy we did it. We covered what we were hoping to cover. We probably didn't have a huge live audience given the odd timing, but hopefully people watch it later.
Yeah.
And
we can replay it tomorrow.
Yeah.
The regular stuff.
Exactly.
Run it back. Yeah.
Anyway, good chat, guys.
Yeah, this was fun.
Let's wrap it.
Till next time.